Blog Talk Radio.
The opinions expressed on Wolf Dog Radio by our guests and participants of the audience are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of the production team of the hosts of Wolf Dog Radio. We are open to your ideas for future radio programs. Please feel free to email us with questions or comments at questions@wolfdogradio.com.
Welcome, everyone. I'm Krista Ward, your host for tonight's Wolf Dog Radio program. Tonight on Wolf Dog Radio, we will be speaking with Jerry Poles, the chairperson of the AVLS Breed Club of Sarlos Wolf Dogs, and with Julie Myack Bradshaw, the founder and chair of the SWDC Sarlos Wolf Dog Club United Kingdom, from their homes to bring us all into the light about the history and heritage of the Sarlos Wolf Dog. Jerry has been involved with Sarlos animals for 7 years, Julie for 5 years. Both have made a very profound impact with and for the Sarlos Wolf Dog. Tonight's interview was hosted by producers Deanna Moose and Greg Largent. We'll join our guest after this brief message from Blue Buffalo.
He's a dog in every sense. Yet in his soul, he's a wolf. Inside every dog lives a spiritual connection to his ancestors in the wild, and nothing connects them more than a desire for meat. So we created Blue Wilderness. It's made with more of the meat your dog loves. Feed the wolf that lives inside your dog with meat-rich Blue Wilderness.
This is Rachel Tilsa, and you are listening to Wolf Dog Radio.
Tonight on Wolf Dog Radio, we're speaking with Jerry Poles, the chairperson of the AVLS Dutch Breed Club of Sarlos Wolf Dogs, and with Julie Myack Bradshaw, who's the founder and chair of the SWDC, which stands for Sarlos Wolf Dog Club UK. Welcome to the show. We're so happy to have you here.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
Well, why don't we start off with each of you individually. Tell us a little bit about yourself and your background with these dogs and what led you to becoming involved with the Sarlos Making Wolf Dog a Breed. Jerry, why don't you start?
Okay, well, my background in dogs started when I was about a year or 12. I always loved dogs, but my parents didn't let me have one until I was old enough to take care of it. And So at age 12, I got my first dog. It was a Doberman, and I had to care for it myself. So I went to the breed club, took lessons in how to handle and train Dobermans, and from that moment on, my life actually has never been without dogs anymore. When I met my husband, he had a wonderful German Shepherd, and he had a breed. He had bred Airedale Terriers in the past. So I really fell in love with my husband, but also with the dog that he had at that moment, the German Shepherd. And from that day on, we actually always had German Shepherd dogs. But they aren't a really healthy breed, so we had to put them to sleep when they were young. So we went searching for a breed that was a little bit healthier and still had the wonderful looks and the loving character that we found the German Shepherd had. And so this became the Sarlos Wolf Dog. We found the Sarlos Wolf Dog, and we fell in love with it right away. My husband not so much, because they do not really have, that's the big difference with the German Shepherd dog, Sir Lewis does not have a will to please. So he had to really learn to be patient with the dog, but after that he found how to handle the Sir Lewis, then he fell in love with them as well, for they have this kind of magical spell that they put on you. So you fall in love with them whether you want to or not. And after we had this Sir Lewis, we joined the breed club, the AVLS. And we have two breeding clubs actually in the Netherlands. And the AVLS is a little bit bigger than the other one, and they breed more. So there are more pups being born in the AVLS. And after being a member for a while, I became actively involved, and so now I'm a board member, as you all know. Well, that's about my background in dogs and the Sir Lewis in particular.
That was a whole lot in just a few paragraphs. I can't wait to get into more of this with you. Julie, how about you?
Okay, well, I grew up in the home of breeders. My mother bred spaniels for the show ring and also as companion pets. My father, being a very keen gunman, always had working dogs, both in field sports and on the land as protection. I came into wolf dogs about a decade ago with a rescue dog, then moved into wolf-like dogs from there. I've been involved in the Sir Lewis in particular since 2013. I chose to import a Sir Lewis to the UK from Europe as a companion pet, but also with a view to potentially breeding them in the UK in the future. At that time, I was a breeder of lupine dogs exclusively, which is a British creation of companion wolf dog that encompasses all types of ethically bred, what we would term as a wolf-like and wolf dogs. But I really fell in love with the Sir Lewis as a breed. I knew from some prior research into the importing that there was a relatively small gene pool with the Sir Lewis, something that I'd had a lot of experience with our British creations, such as the Northern Inuit, the Tamascan dog, which you're probably more familiar with in the US, Utenog and Timber dog, etc. But the Sir Lewis had been recognized as a breed in its own right in Europe since 1975, and I was born in the late 70s. It wasn't recognized as a breed in the UK. It's still not, despite various historical efforts for it to become so. There was no breed club representing the breed in the UK and Ireland back in 2013, so a group of wolf dog enthusiasts and owners of the Sir Lewis in the UK, we got together and formed the United Kingdom and Ireland Sir Lewis Wolf Dog Club, which was officially accepted by our kennel club in 2015. The breed itself is not recognized, but one of the first steps towards becoming recognized is that you have to form a breed club in line with both Europe's kennel clubs and both with the kennel club here. So I've been a great lover of the Sir Lewis since 2013, really. My first one just captured me, and as Jerry says, they certainly do put a spell on you, and I've been hooked from there.
Well, thank you, Julie. That was great. There's so much information there that we're going to delve into in just a little bit. I thank you, and good evening. Jerry, the Sir Lewis Wolf Dog is a native breed to the Netherlands. What is the history of the Sir Lewis Wolf Dog as to when and how did it begin, and when did it become a recognized breed?
Yes, well, it all started with the founder, Leendert Saarloos, and he actually started breeding German Shepherds way back in 1926. But he, like me, thought the German Shepherd wasn't a very strong breed anymore. So his answer to that was to pair it to a female wolf. And so he got a European wolf called Fleur, and he got her from the Rotterdam Zoo. Unfortunately, this first wolf pup that he had grew up with German shepherds, but she got sick and died. So the zoo gave him another one, another female wolf, and in spring of 1936, he had his first litter of pups from a German shepherd male called Gerard from Transrhenen, and his wolf from the zoo from Rotterdam. Unfortunately, bad luck struck again, and all the pups died within a month. But the next year he had a second litter, and that is actually the very first start of the breed. And they wanted to get the breed recognized back in 1942. Leendert Sarloes went to the Big Winner Show and took 16 of his Dutch wolf dogs, as he called them at that moment, with him, and they tried to get the breed recognized, but, well, unfortunately, the Dutch Kennel Club said no. So after the Second World War, Sarloes found out by accident, actually, that the Sarloes wolf dog is actually a very good dog as a guiding dog for the blind. He wanted them to be police dogs because the German Shepherd dog was always a very good police dog. But the shyness that comes from the wolf made sure that they couldn't be a police dog. They do not have a will to attack anyone. But after the war, he found out that they could be actually real good in guiding dogs for the blind. For a blind lady in his neighborhood lost her dog, and she asked him to give him one of his dogs, and so he did. And in 1944, he starts a Dutch wolf dog club, and a training center to train the wolf dogs to be good guiding dogs for the blind. And they really worked for several years as good blind guiding dogs for blind people. In 1956, Sarloes gets his last female wolf. This is number six, actually. He had six wolves that came from the zoo. And we are not sure if he bred all wolves, though, but he had six wolves. And this number six, they are all called Fleur. Not very not very easy for us to keep them apart, but, well, this is what he did. And this last wolf was had some offspring, and that is the moment that we have the official recognition from our kennel club. In 1975, the Dutch Kennel Club, which is called Raad van Beheer, recognized this breed as being a real breed, and the offspring from Fleur number six is being put in the registers. In the stud book? Do you call that stud book?
Yes.
Yeah? Okay, so the offspring was put into the stud book of our kennel club. And Leendert Sarloes, unfortunately, didn't really make it until 1975, for he died in 69. So he never got to see the breed being recognized. But the Breeders' Club made sure that the name now wasn't Dutch Wolf Dog, but Sarloes Wolf Dog, to honor the man who really founded this breed. So that's about it, I guess.
What an interesting beginning. I just have a comment to make regarding your story. I find it interesting that wolves have a reputation of attacking everybody, yet this breed was better as a guide dog because it had no will to attack.
Yes, well, European wolves actually are really, really shy. They're not comparable to the timber wolves in the States, for maybe they are a little bit more aggressive. I'm not sure about that. But European dogs, European wolves, you can hardly see, actually. And if they really attack, then it's only to eat, so it's sheep or anything like that, but not really to humans. They rather hide than attack.
So much for all the stories.
Yeah, well, this is a bit, I think the stories are somewhat overdone because of all the fairy tales, but they're not really true.
Now, and what was the wolf content in these animals by the time it was recognized, or did you measure that?
By the time it was recognized, it was real, we talk about, you know, of Fleur number 6. So this was the F1 generation, actually, that was recognized. But today, it's far away from that. I guess my dogs, my own Sarlouz wolf dogs, are somewhat like F10 or F15. They're not really close to the wolf anymore.
Okay. Well, now, Julie, it's your turn. What were the requirements that you had to complete in order to start the journey of having the Sarlouz recognized as a breed in the UK? I know it had to have been really easy.
No, and it's still not. But the Sarlouz is obviously officially recognized throughout most of mainland Europe, and it's officially recognized in Southern Ireland, which helps us a lot. As obviously Northern Ireland is part of the UK. The breed standard already exists, obviously, from Europe, so the UK have adopted the same breed standard for its official breed club here in the UK. We obviously, the first step is to form a breed club, as I mentioned before, in which I'm currently acting as the chairperson, but it's the responsibility of the club to submit an application for an import register, first of all, for the Sarlouz wolf dog into the United Kingdom. In order for us to apply for an import register, we have to have 20 considered unrelated dogs, and by that they mean more distantly related cousins and more distantly related than that. And those 20 dogs all have to very closely meet the breed standard. They have to have been imported or bred from stock from Europe. And we currently have around 15 dogs that meet those sort of quite strict regulations. They're both imported stock and stock that's now been bred here in the UK. So we've still got quite a way to go. We also have to submit all the conformational show reports from the Sarlouz wolf dog around Europe, so the other international shows, club shows and championship shows around Europe. And we have to enter our own British stock, as it's referred to, into European regulated shows to ensure that they do in fact meet that breed standard to a very good degree. We also have to submit a breeding plan that requires that meets all the requirements of our own kennel club standards here in the UK, and it also has to be within the kennel club code of ethics that we have here in the UK. The UK Sarlouz Wolf Dog Club, it's very keen to work very closely with other breed clubs around Europe, but it has a particularly great working relationship with the AVLS in the Netherlands, obviously, as one of the two Dutch breed clubs that form the breed.
Very interesting, very interesting. I have a follow-up question for you. Do you go through the same regime or the same process of importing a wolf or a wolf dog into the UK as you would go through with importing a dog? Do you have to meet the same standards, or do they differ?
It's actually the same standards. The standards here are based on good husbandry and good animal welfare. So they are the same standards, be it dog or wolf dog, or indeed wolf, if you have the permit to do so. You do need a special permit for a wolf, though. Here in the UK, it would be the wolf, F1 and F2. That would require that permit, everything, but it would still be the same. You would still have to abide by the same rules for animal welfare importing those dogs.
Okay, well, thank you. Thank you, Julie. I appreciate that. Jerry, what subspecies of wolf was involved in the creation of the Saarloos wolf dog in the Netherlands?
Even though we do have a lot of records, we cannot really say for sure what subspecies wolf this was, because at that time, we're talking about in the 30s years, they really didn't know that there were subspecies of wolf. So in Rotterdam Zoo, they just had wolves. And we now think that they were European wolves, because of their looks. We do have some pictures, and they're not real big for a wolf. European wolf is a little bit smaller than, for example, the timber wolf. And so we think it's the European wolf. The later wolf, Fleur number 6, we still do not have the official record, but the daughter of Mr. Leendert Saarloos is still alive, and she is a member of the AVLS, and she has a lot of stories, of course, because she grew up with these animals. And, she says she's pretty sure that it was a European wolf that was the subspecies. So Eurasian wolf, it's called also. So this is actually what we know.
Okay.
So I hope this is an answer to your question.
Oh, yes, it was excellent. Thank you. Was there ever any DNA from any of the original animals? And I know that, you know, collecting DNA samples was probably, it's a relatively new thing any place in the world is to collect DNA samples, but do you have or have any DNA samples been collected from any of the animals that are in the registry or that came to make the registry happen?
Not for the founder animals, of course, because they are all gone, and there were no DNA tests possible, like you said. But today, these days, we always, every owner of Saarloos that wants to breed with the dog, they need to get the DNA tested, because it's just an obligation here to be able to breed. And we have we register with My Dog DNA. This is somewhat like Embark, but a little bit different. And there are a lot of Saarloos in there, and they can see that they are related to this gray wolf, the European gray wolf, but we do not have DNA tests from the founder dogs, unfortunately. That would be nice, though.
Yes, that would be excellent to be able to look back and see. The generations, I believe, how many generations are there documented in your breed history?
Okay. Well, the Kennel Club they go back to Fleur number 6, what I told you. This is 1956. And I guess it's about, you can say, I guess it's about 20 to 30 generations even, but most Sarlous are somewhat between 11 to 15 at the moment. So, we do not have the Kennel Club accepting all the first founders, but Marijke Sarlous does have all the registration of the very first litters from the very first wolf. So we do have documentary about this, but it's not in the stud book from our Kennel Club. They go. They started in 1956. The dogs that are the first offspring, they were F1, of course, from Fleur, number six, wolf number six. And, so this is an F1 generation, and up to these days, they go way back. We don't really talk about F generations anymore. They're just dogs in the Netherlands. Nobody with a Sarlous says, well, it's F3 or F6 or F11. We don't talk about that anymore. It's just a normal dog, even though it's not really normal, but it's considered to be just a dog.
Yeah, I like what you said previously about it being an obligation with the breeders and the members to have their animals DNA tested. It's not, I mean, it's a requirement, but it's seen as being more of an obligation. I would love for that to carry over across the ocean and hit the United States and the rest of the world. That'd be a great and wonderful thing. I thank you.
Okay. Well, I have to say a little bit about this, though, because even though we are now obligated for those DNA tests, I must say it wasn't in the past. So some breeders could, you know, play a little bit and pretend that it was a Sarlous with a Sarlous, but in fact it was still, we know there are some wolves crossed in there. Even after Fleur number six, we know that there were some wolves sneaked in there before there were those DNA tests. So some of the Sarlous do have a little bit more wolfy genes than the others, but we are really happy that those things can't happen anymore now with the DNA tests.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, just to follow on from that, Greg, I mean, it's still not an official requirement in the UK with our Kennel Club to DNA test any breed of dog that you register with them. But because, like Kerry mentioned, that we do know that other breeders around Europe perhaps haven't been as strict with keeping the breed Sarlous to Sarlous as it should be historically, and that there have been more recent wolf additions than are listed in the stud book. So actually, a lot has changed really just in the last decade, with DNA testing becoming more available on the sort of, domestic market, and therefore now the breed club that we formed here in the UK does require all the animals that are imported to be DNA tested to confirm that they are from European registered stock. And that is just to prevent that happening again in the future, that no one can sneak any more wolves or other dogs into that gene pool. Or at least
here
not be happening officially.
Well,
here in the States, with AKC, with the AKC registration, the males, if the males stud more than, I believe it's two or three litters, then they have to have their cheek swabbed, so at least the male's DNA is on record. Is that going to be done even with the animals that aren't imported, just to make sure it might not be happening after they get imported?
Here in the UK, I mean, in the Netherlands, all rare stock is DNA tested every generation. Here in the UK, we do have to kind of abide to the Kennel Club's rules. As a breed club, yes, we do make sure that all those dogs continue to be DNA tested. But for the Kennel Club, if you see what I'm saying, we can't enforce that, no. So only those dogs that are involved in the breed club will guaranteed to be DNA tested to match their parents.
Excellent. And I also noticed in one of the, we had a question about is DNA required now for both animals to be registered? And on your responses, you spoke about shyness. Could you please could you give us a little bit more detail on that answer?
Of course. In terms of the traits, behavioral traits, yes, you know, the dogs, they are still very natural, both in physical type and to an extent in temperament, so that shyness is still inherited from its wolf ancestry. It's a sweet shyness. It should be aloof, especially towards a stranger, but it's not an aggressive, it's not fear reactive, and it certainly shouldn't show any excessive guarding tendencies. More along the lines of what you would see in a sighthound, a natural aloofness towards strangers.
Mm-hmm. Like, for example, if someone comes to visit our house, the dogs, I always let them be able to go outside because they live inside with us. And so I will open the door and they can go out if someone visits us, but they never do actually because they are curious as well as shy. So they stay in the room, but they will not approach the visitor. So this is the kind of shyness we're talking about. And only if the visitor stays and sits down and is very calm, then sometimes one of them just comes near to, you know, check out if this is a good person or not. But they will not, like our German Shepherd, she comes up to any stranger and greets and says, "Hi, I'm here, pet me, pet me." Well, they will not do so. So this is the shyness we're talking about.
Thank you.
Okay.
All righty. Jerry, I have I'm sorry. I'll be asking each of you the same question, so, Jerry, that's fine. Could you tell us about the personality traits of the Sarlouz, and what are your requirements as to what those personality traits have to be, or minimum standards, or what the requirements are?
Julie, will you go first?
Yes, of course. The Sarlouz is today bred as a companion dog. The ability to work as a guide dog was filtered away, really, in the breeding after the last wolf, Fleur the sixth. And today they're very much registered and bred as companion dog breeds. So, you know, they're gentle, they're very sweet, they're very, very loyal to their families, to the people that they know. It's essential in the UK, especially, our dangerous dog laws are very strict. That they are solid in nature, and, you know, not reactive dogs, either to people or to other dogs. They require a lot of human interaction. You know, they don't do very well when they're left at home alone for long periods of time. They can become like all large breeds, and certainly anybody with a wolf dog will tell you, they become quite destructive. They're also very much still a pack animal, and therefore they have to be either with other dogs or with people to get that companionship. On the contrary to a lot of American breeding, they certainly are very different in the sense that they actually make very good house dogs. As adolescents, they can be a bit more difficult, but as adults, they make great house pets. They prefer to be in the house. They prefer to be with you. they should really be kept as such, so we're not terribly keen on the idea of them being kennelled or kept outside in enclosures. Like all large breeds, they do require a lot of physical exercise and a lot of mental stimulation. However, they're not highly driven dogs. So on the contrary to German Shepherds or working dogs, they're actually not bouncing off the walls if you don't take them for a four-hour hike every day. They're quite happy if you can't do that one day to just lie on the sofa with you. And also, you know, I mean, they're a great dog in the sense that they actually require quite minimal grooming, except for in the spring. And everybody who has any knowledge of wolf dogs would appreciate what I mean by that. Jerry?
Yeah, well, I agree with Julie. They're just most wonderful sofa dogs. they love to cuddle towards you and be near you all the time. As Julie was saying, after Fleur number 6, the guiding dog abilities became less and less good. This is partly because there was another wolf crossed in there, so the shyness took a bigger part of the dog. And besides that, after World War II, the traffic in the Netherlands became much busier. So it was very hard for them to keep track on that all. So they're not, you know, after Fleur number 6, they were not being used as guiding dogs for the blinds anymore, but they are really the most wonderful pets you can ever imagine. And as Julie said, they really need to live indoors with the family. We really, in the Netherlands, we don't want them to be outside in kennels as well, because they just aren't happy there. They want to be with the pack, and the family is the pack, so they want to stay inside with you. They are really kind to other dogs. There are usually no fights there. Sometimes they can see the smaller dogs as being a prey, because they do have a drive to hunt prey, because, of course, this is what wolves do. But you can train them pretty good. So there are a lot of Sarlouz dogs that live with cats or live with even rabbits without doing anything to them. I for sure know one Sarlouz wolf dog that just lives while chicken are walking around him. But I must be honest, my own Sarlouz wolf dog I would not trust with any rabbit or chicken anywhere near. So it's a big compliment to the person that trained that dog, actually, because they really like their prey. And this also counts for my kitchen. I cannot leave anything lying on my kitchen. Like, if there's anything to eat in there, you can bet that it's not there if I turn my back towards it. So they're really dogs, but dogs with a little bit more wolfy character than your average Labrador, I guess. They're really smart, too. They can open any door.
Doesn't what a friend. Matter.
They, yeah. They can even open slide doors or never mind what kind of door. Even we heard about a Sarlouz here in the Netherlands that just opens the microwave and gets the chicken out of there. So they're really smart. They can really, if they think there's a need to it, they can learn anything. But they need to find that it's needy to learn, because you can try to teach them, but then they'll go like, well, if I don't think I can use it, then you better go do something else.
Reminds me of my husband. No.
Yeah.
I agree with that. It would be like training a man. It's certainly, there's got to be something in it for them, for sure. There's got to be something in it for them.
I believe I'm being outgunned at the present moment. But back onto the questions. Yes, I think if one day any of us see an animal on their back legs at a combination lock turning the dial, we're in real trouble. We're in real trouble. that hasn't happened yet, but you never know for future generations. How do the Saarloos do if they need to be rehomed? It from your descriptions, it sounds and is obviously that the Saarloos are a higher F gen, and which makes them more closer to dog, and they're more gentle and tame and into the family structure and units. Does that make it difficult to rehome them if that's required?
Yes, actually it is. And this is why, well, thank goodness, in the Netherlands, there are not much Saarloos that need to be rehomed. So I'm very grateful for that. And if they need to be rehomed, then the AVLS, the Breed Club, and some other people we know really help to replace them, rehome them, because they really can be very sad. But, you know, it is done. If it's really needed, then it can be done. But it takes a lot of effort and love and patience for the new owner to make sure that everything goes well there. Yeah, they really do not like to be apart from. Yeah, well, what they concern is their pack. So it's hard for them.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with Jerry completely. It is very difficult, actually, especially with adult dogs. Obviously, how they are raised and how they are trained can help with that, but it doesn't always. And because of that, there is quite a strict regulation, certainly within our breed club, that all the breeders must take their animals back if that dog needs to be rehomed, and then the breeder themselves must go through the lengthy process of rehoming the dog and supporting the future owner to help that dog integrate. But it is difficult, certainly as adults, and we are very lucky here in the UK too. I mean, we don't have a huge population. I mean, I mentioned that we have 15 dogs that are eligible for our register, but as a population, we have many more than that. We actually have around 150, 200 dogs in the UK that have been imported at various different points in history and bred on from there. But, we're very lucky. We also don't have a huge amount of rescue or rehome cases as well. I think that's, in a way, it's quite unique to the Saarloos. I think that, like I say, they do rather cast a spell on you. So, you know, the need for rehoming hasn't yet become a major issue, but obviously the more popular a breed becomes, that is something that we'll address as we come to it. And like I say, the breed club have already put a sort of backup clause in place there to make sure that the breeders are taking responsibility for that.
Thank goodness.
Yeah.
Thank goodness.
Excellent. Yeah, it's great news to hear that there are not that many Saarloos wolf dogs in you know, from either of your registries that are in need of being rehomed. It says a lot for how they're bred, and says even more for the owners and the breeders that must do some pretty rigorous screening. So you're to be commended for that, for sure. Jerry, a question for you. Could you tell us about the Saarloos Wolf Dog Outcross project by the AVLS in the Netherlands, and why you feel it's necessary and what it involves, please?
Okay, well, the Saarloos wolf dog has a very small gene pool, and in order to keep the breed healthy, we had to take action because there are some health issues in the breed. Most of the problems we can test on, like DM or HD, you know, the hip, this, I don't know the English word for that. hip dysplasia. Yeah, okay, and the elbow dysplasia. And so there are some eye issues, and we have all dogs that people want to breed with. We have them all tested for that, and so we can kind of control those health problems. But, you know, there is this problem of cancers in the dog that become more and more more and more dogs seem to get cancer, and also with epileptic seizures. And so we know actually that this comes from the immune system, and because of the gene pool that is so narrow, the immune system gets holes in it. And in order to get this net of immune system repaired, we need to get some real other genes in there, actually. And so we have had some real professionals in genetics advise us, and we are working with the Dutch Kennel Club and these genetic scientists, and we started the Outcross program. And this means that we take a completely different breed and breed it into the Saarloos, and then breed back to the Saarloos. So this makes the breed get more genes, but at the same time, because of we breeding back to the Saarloos, we will try to keep the specific characteristics and looks from the Saarloos intact, of course. And we monitor everything very close, and the F1 or F2 generations of this outcross can only be used in further breeding if the AVLS Selection Commission, together with the Dutch Kennel Club, says when it's okay to breed with this particular offspring. So, this is actually what happened. We had a Swiss White Shepherd bred into the breed, a working line Husky, and the latest was a Podenco. And we had some lookalikes come in, and they were judged on their looks and character and health, and they really needed to be able to show their... background, you know, so that we know where they came from, and then they will be used in our outcross program in the future. And some people say, why don't you use another wolf? But we don't really think that's a very good idea, especially since the Netherlands are a very crowdy, small country, so we don't think that would be a good idea. So this is not going to happen. But we had some other breeds crossed into the Saarloos to make sure that our breed stays healthy. And we think this is a must to do. And of course, we also have a lot of Saarloos breeding to another Saarloos as well. We do need a lot of pups to be able to keep the breed healthy, but besides that, we really think outcross is necessary. Yeah.
No, I have to say that I am so impressed with the thought process and the planning you have, and the fact that you have a selection commission that, and I don't want to use the word call, that has a negative, but that these animals are not good. You have a standard, and that you have
yes.
a commission that keeps that standard, and you know, you have an interchange of thought of different people as to whether this is a good trait that you want to bring in or a bad. And I really have to commend you on that. That is something, you know, for us to think about here.
Thank you.
Now, Miss Julie, how does the UK Club feel about this Outcross project?
Okay. Well, as a breeder personally, I mean, my focus over the last decade has really been on the health and temperament of the wolfy type dogs. So I personally wholeheartedly support this Outcross project. I'm, as I said earlier, I'm very familiar with the problems that are created by these very narrow, very small gene pools. These are problems that we can't really test for. You know, we can test for the hips, like Jerry says, and we can test for all those known problems like degenerative myopathy, different forms of dwarfism that we see within the breeds, but we can't test for these autoimmune problems such as the, you know, the epilepsy or the cancers and various other problems that occur when you do have these gaps in your immune system that are really created by having a very narrow genetic information, genetic pool. And therefore, you know, it very much rings true to me, to my heart, to my origins in the Lupine Foundation, which was really to amalgamate all these different wolfy breeds, wolfy types and lookalikes that was created to kind of centralize and create a more diverse and sustainable breeding population for all the wolf dogs in the UK. But sadly, at this time, the UK Wolf Dog Club and the Kennel Club here in the UK won't allow us to use any of the outcrossed dogs or dogs with known outcross origins. That's just because our UK Kennel Club register, obviously, it's still in the process of going through. We're still not officially recognised here. We're still being very closely monitored, and everything that we do is being very closely scrutinised. But on the flip side of that, we are in discussions with the Irish Kennel Club, because, as I said, the breed is recognised in Southern Ireland, and the Irish Kennel Club are supporting us, working very closely with us to gain recognition here in the UK, and they are going to begin talks with Radboud Rea over in the Netherlands and see if we cannot add some of those to our gene pool here in the UK in the future, so we will be able to use these selectively outcrossed dogs further down the line in future generations, and they will still be accepted on our import register in the future, hopefully. So I guess it's kind of a watch this space subject with that, but no, at the moment, no, but certainly hopefully in the future, because it is very important for a breed, for any dog, to have a diverse genetic pool in order to sustain it for our children, children's children, and for the future.
Definitely critical for survival. Okay, would you ever consider having a chapter of wolf in the United States and branching out?
Sorry, is that the World of Lupines Foundation or the Salus?
Yes.
The World of Lupines Foundation.
Either or.
Yes, of course. So I would love to see both, actually, mostly because, you know, I think that structure, ethics, codes of ethics, structure, having input from genetic experts, from the scientists involved with the kennel clubs these days, it's all very, very useful, and we have such a lot of tools at our disposal in order to you don't have to create a breed per se, but you certainly have to take responsibility for animals that we as humans are producing, and therefore having some kind of umbrella organization, whether that be a breed club or part of the World of Lupines Foundation, for the much larger aspects of breeding wolf dogs in general, then yes, because, you know, breeders need to be held accountable, and they certainly need to be working towards what is considered good practice in the 21st century, which is, you know, to be thoroughly health testing their dogs, to be selective about the dogs that they use, to make sure the dogs they breed are to a standard, regardless of what that standard is, to make sure that there's consistency and to ensure them from a legal point of view for the future. You know, only by keeping good records and only by
having evidence in the form of health and in the form of ancestry through DNA and both through just good old-fashioned paperwork, only then can we guarantee that our children, our children's children, etc., will go on to enjoy these dogs. I would like to see both. I would like to see the Sorlus do very well in America. It would certainly help our aim here in the UK. Surprisingly, the UK Kennel Club, being the original kennel club, is still quite old-fashioned. And the American Kennel Club, I think, are kind of a happy medium between the UK and Europe. Europe's kennel clubs are very progressive and very forward-thinking, so I would like to see more uniformity between just the kennel clubs, but certainly a lot more uniformity worldwide where wolf dogs are concerned.
Do you agree with this also, Jerry?
Okay.
Yes, I agree totally. Yes, the AVLS is very keen on having the breed recognized in England, but the same, like Julie said, we would love it to be a breed in the United States as well. And I think I agree with Julie on everything she said. Yes.
Just as a point of clarification, you're both stating that you do not support indiscriminate breeding without a purpose, correct?
Correct.
Indiscriminate? Breeding without
just
a purpose.
Breeding with no purpose. I knew that's what you were both saying, and the reason I asked that was to emphasize to our listening audience that that's what something that many people here in the States are saying, is that, you know, you don't need to just acquire animals and breed them just because you can, that there needs to be a purpose and a goal rather than just adding to the number of animals that are running around on the ground that need homes. So I just wanted to emphasize that. Well, ladies, those are the questions that we have for you. Do either of you have anything else that you would like to add?
I'm not sure. I think we discussed the training, didn't we, of Sarlis Wolf Dogs? I think I'd like to sort of just touch on the fact that when I visit America and when I speak to my, you know, sort of associates with wolf dogs in America, the stark contrast always seems to be that people believe that somehow European wolf dogs aren't wolf dogs, and that American wolf dogs are more wolf dog. And I'm not sure really where that comes from. And we're certainly, you know, in terms of filial, things are certainly very different here. That's mostly down to record keeping more than anything else. We are historically a bit more accurate with our record keeping. But as I say, there's been odd wolves snuck in, certainly up until the last decade that was happening. Mm-hmm. So it's not necessarily true that a European wolf dog is somehow less of a wolf dog than American wolf dogs. I think what the difference is usually the filial, and the difference is usually that they have been bred more specifically for a purpose or to a standard.
And maybe because
but I do find that in training, people often assume that they are somehow very dog-like, and actually they're not. You know, they are certain aspects of their characters. Like we were saying, that they prefer to be in the home, they prefer to be with family, they prefer and do well as house pets, but really other than that, training is very similar. You know, there really has to be something in it for them, and it's not always reliable, and they're not a dog. You know, they're not a Labrador, they're not a Spaniel. They're still very much wolf dogs here in Europe, and I hope that people in America can look at the breeds and the breeds that have been founded here in Europe and perhaps have a think about that and think about where they want to take that in the future with American animals.
I agree with Julie on that, and Another difference is maybe the subspecies of wolf that was used here is a different type of wolf than, for example, a timber wolf. But I agree also in what Julie says is it's a family pet here, but you really, it's not just your ordinary dog. You really need to socialize them very, very well, because otherwise it can be a very disappointing experience for both owner as well as wolf dog. So socializing and training is very, very important. Really from the start already. So our AVLS Breeders Club really says to all the breeders to socialize the pups from day one, actually, well, maybe day four, but real soon. Like Julie is, for example, taking part of this puppy. How do you say it, Julie? Puppy.
Oh, the Puppy Culture Program, which is
yes.
Actually an American program. Yeah.
Yeah, it's an American program, but still, it's very good to socialize the pets, because otherwise they're not just your ordinary German Shepherd or Labrador. Absolutely not. They're really wolf dogs. So.
And wolf dogs wolf dogs are so much more. I think you would cheat yourself an experience of an amazing animal if you didn't socialize and you didn't follow through. I think they are so much more. And so I agree with you wholeheartedly. Do you all have, can we just get your URLs, your webpage where people can get some more information about you? Julie, why don't you go first? Give us your website, webpage.
Sure. The Saarloos Wolf Dog Club in the UK here is www.saarloos.org.uk. And then as a breeder, it's myax.co.uk.
Excellent. And Jerry, how about for you?
Yes, well, our breeders club is www.avls.nl. And for my page, you just put into Google Silva Amica, and then you will find it. It's a hard address to just spell, so put in Silva Amica and in Google, and you will find it. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right, ladies.
I want to thank
you both for taking time from your evenings to both prepare for and to speak with us. This is something that Deanne and I have been kind of kicking around for quite a while. Was getting with people in other breeds and other breed clubs from around the world to see how they do things and what their ideas are and how it's working. And from the sound of it, both of you and your organizations are leaps and bounds and miles ahead of anything that's going on here in the States. You know, you actually have there are a couple of different people that have done breeding for distinct purposes and with a distinct look and kept track of the animals that they breed so that they have their own enclosed, self-enclosed and self-made little breed of wolf dog. But you've done this on such a grand scale and legitimized it, so to say, that you know, you and your organizations are to be commended. It's a huge task and it's a huge undertaking, and we appreciate you spending time with us.
Well, thank you, Greg, and especially for giving the Saarloos some time on your radio station.
We will be right back after these messages from Pet to Be.
Does your dog suffer from bad breath, itchy skin, or any of the other common canine ailments? Check the ingredients on your dog food. Do you see wheat, corn, potato, or rice products? Is there a long list of synthetic vitamins? Your dog has the same digestive system as a wolf, coyote, dingo, or any other kind of wild dog. But when was the last time you heard of wolves or coyotes attacking farmers' wheat or corn crops? Pedobee is a family-owned business that produces premium raw dog food from local ingredients. Our products are preserved through freezing, not chemicals or heat pasteurization. Do your dog and yourself a favor and start feeding your dog according to their design with Pedobee Premium Raw.
This is Paula Ficarra
and Steve Westell,
founders of Apex Protection Project.
And you're listening to Wolf Dog Radio.
We have a special announcement from our friends at Project Coyote. Project Coyote has produced a documentary film featuring scientists, ranchers, advocates, and government officials to expose killing contests, raise awareness of their ecological consequences, and inspire action. The film will debunk myths used to perpetuate these contests and will highlight successful efforts to ban them. Please listen to the trailer for The Hidden War on Wildlife, Ending Killing Contests.
Few Americans have ever heard of a practice called wildlife killing contests, and yet this practice is legal throughout most of the United States. This is a practice of killing wildlife, everything from coyotes, mountain lions, bears, bobcats, to even wolves, for basically prizes and fun. And what Project Coyote is doing is we're starting a trend here in California to ban this practice. We're using legislation, litigation, and education to raise awareness that this is going on throughout North America and that we have an opportunity to stop this barbarity.
One of the greatest impediments to stopping these wildlife killing contests is that most people don't know they exist. So to counter that, Project Coyote is making a documentary film in which we will interview all the stakeholders, the bounty and hunting proponents, conservationists, wildlife scientists, community leaders. We want to make this story public. We want to bring it out into the light of day and let you decide.
Today here in Van Nuys, we took action to clarify that offering prizes or rewards or any form of inducement for a wildlife killing contest in the state of California is unlawful. And we did this because we feel that wildlife killing contests are an anachronism. They are antiquated and they're inconsistent with our understanding of the role of predators and other species in ecosystems today.
So we're hoping that this victory in California will set the trend for the rest of the nation. And we're setting our sights on other states, New Mexico and other places across North America, to emulate what we've done here in California and to empower citizens and communities to take the lead to ban this heinous practice in their areas.
To make a film requires a film crew, requires resources, and requires travel. We can't do this on our own. Our budget is dedicated to fighting these wildlife killing contests, to educating people, legislators, community leaders. This is something extra that we feel we need to do, and we're asking you to join us. Your contribution in any amount will be a real contribution to getting this story told, protecting the environment against having the apex predators removed, and stopping this barbaric sport, which sends a very chilling message that animals are disposable, that killing is fun,
25 pounds,
and life is cheap. Please help us.
Please go to www.projectcoyote.org and join them in ending this horrific practice. Donate a dollar or whatever you can. Every effort you make makes a difference. When we work together, anything is possible. Remember, www.projectcoyote.org. Now it's time for Wolf Dog Radio News.
And now it's time for Wolf Dog Radio News with Greg Largent.
Good evening. Wolf Dog Radio has a special message that they wish to bring to you. Tonight, I want to remind our listeners of the plight of the wolves throughout Europe and the severe danger they have been placed by governments which are approving wolf kill numbers primarily to appease the farmers that own cattle and sheep and the hunters that are clamoring for the opportunity to join the hunt. Wolf depredation is a serious issue and needs to be addressed in a scientific, controlled fashion, which reported wolf kills are investigated by competent, trained biologists or game personnel. Sadly, this is not the case. Animal compensation claims are, for the most part, paid with little or no investigation. The farmer's word is taken as being true. Bona fide claims are one thing, and compensation should be paid if everything is in order. The rush to kill wolves to reduce their numbers, to reduce the supposed threat, as is the current practice, without the use of non-lethal measures being utilized, is not in the best interest of wolves or their environment. Please lend your voice and support petitions and initiatives that support the requirement for non-lethal measures to be utilized to end wolf kills to appease farmers and hunters. Unproven and unwarranted agendas. Visit wolfdogradio.com for information within our two blog sections titled Wolves from Around the World and National Wolf Awareness. Killing wolves is not and should not be the immediate response or the preferred response for wolf management. Thank you.
The Vet Tech is in.
Tonight on The Vet Tech is in, I would like to discuss the canine influenza epidemic. Canine influenza, also known as the dog flu, is spread through nasal secretions, direct contact, infected surfaces or objects, or through people transferring it by not taking proper precautionary measures to remain sanitary. Currently, two strains of the canine influenza virus have been identified in the United States. The H3N8 strain of canine influenza was first identified in 2004 in Florida. Since then, it has been found in several other states. In 2015, the H3N2 virus strain was identified as the cause of an outbreak of canine influenza in Chicago. The virus was known to exist in Asia, but the 2015 outbreak was the first report of the H3N2 virus affecting dogs outside of Asia. The doggy flu cannot infect humans, but it can infect felines. There are some specific strains to canines alone, but there are also strains that allow it to cross over and infect their feline friends, prominent year-round. The symptoms of canine influenza virus resemble those of canine infectious tracheobronchitis, also known as kennel cough. Dogs infected with canine influenza virus develop a persistent cough and may develop a thick nasal discharge and fever, often between 104 and 105 degrees. Other signs can include lethargy, eye discharge, and reduced appetite. Canine influenza infections can cause mild to severe illness in dogs. Some infected dogs may not show any signs of the illness but can still be contagious and able to infect other dogs. Most canines recover within 2 to 3 weeks. However, some dogs may develop secondary bacterial infections, which may lead to more severe illnesses and pneumonia. Anyone with concerns about their pet's health or whose pet is showing signs of canine influenza should contact their veterinarian immediately. There are laboratory tests available through your veterinarian to diagnose canine influenza. Dogs infected with canine influenza are most contagious during the 2 to 4 day virus incubation period, which they shed the virus in their nasal secretions but do not show signs of the illness. The virus is highly contagious, and almost all dogs exposed to canine influenza will become infected. The majority, approximately 80% of infected dogs, develop flu-like illness. The mortality rate from canine influenza virus is low. It's less than 10%. To reduce the spread of the virus, isolate dogs that are sick or showing signs of a respiratory illness and isolate dogs known to have been exposed to the infected dog. Isolate dogs infected with H3N2 canine influenza for at least 21 days and dogs infected with the other strain, H3N8, for at least a week. Practice good hygiene and sanitation, including hand washing and thorough cleaning of shared items and kennels to reduce the spread of canine influenza virus. Influenza viruses do not usually survive in the environment past 2 days and are inactivated or killed by commonly used disinfectants. Vaccines are available for both strains of the canine influenza virus. The vaccination is a lifestyle-type vaccination recommended for dogs at risk of exposure due to their increased exposure to other dogs, such as boarding, day camps, and attending other social events where dogs are present, visiting dog parks, etc. Your veterinarian can provide you with additional information about the vaccinations and whether you should consider vaccinating your dog against this. Veterinary expertise is required to determine treatment options and the best course of treatment. Treatment for the canine influenza virus, as for most viral diseases, is largely supportive care. Good husbandry and nutrition may help dogs mount an effective immune response. Most dogs recover from canine influenza within 2 to 3 weeks. Secondary bacterial infections, pneumonia, dehydration, or other factors such as pregnancy or pre-existing pulmonary diseases, immunosuppression, tracheal collapse, etc., may add additional diagnostics and treatments. Anti-inflammatories may be used to reduce fevers. Also, antibiotics to reduce the risk of secondary infections. IV fluids may help correct dehydration or maintain hydration. Treatment modification should be made as needed based on response to treatment, other health factors, and other factors such as compliance and animal care capabilities of the owner and the caretaker. It's best to avoid highly populated areas if you are concerned about your furry friend contracting the doggy flu. Vaccinations, again, are available upon request, but many strains may uprise in the future. For more information or if any concerns may occur, please contact your veterinarian immediately. Thank you again for listening to The Vet Tech Is In. My name is Krista Ward. Have a fantastic day.
And now it's time for everyone's favorite Raging Cajun, Jerry Mills.
Good evening, and welcome to my den. Wolves have had a unique fascination for men for all times, and it still holds true today. Legends and tales about wolves are found amongst all people around the world. While all Native Americans, our first people, have had many different tales of the animals, the moose, the beaver, the fox, the coyote, and also, of course, the wolf. Well, I would like to share one such story. It's an Algonquin legend about a dog defecting from wolf people to live with humans. We often hear the saying that dog is man's best friend. But before the dog came to live with humans, it belonged to the dog family. And there amongst the wolves, the dogs had to do all the errands. Well, one cold day, the wolves ordered the dog to go to a man's wigwam to get a fire. This was the only place that the wolves knew that they could get fire, but it was very dangerous for any wolf to go there. The wolves had often gone to Indian villages to get fire, but they would always drop the coals, and the humans would get the fire back. Or, as they carried a burning stick, it would burn brighter, and they would put or otherwise be singed by the flames. Well, the dog knew all this and decided that it would be a very difficult job to get fire from humans. So the dog decided that he would just pretend to try to steal fire, but not really go through with it. Well, the dog knew that if he failed in the mission to get the fire, life with the wolves would be just simply unbearable, and instead he decided he would just leave the wolves and go live with the humans. The dog left the wolves' country and went through the forest to the Indian village. He saw smoke coming out of the smoke holes of the wigwams and went towards one of the houses. He stood in the doorway and looked inside and realized that the hunters were not home. Only the women and children were there. Well, the people had always feared the wolves, so the dog decided that it might just be a good idea to show that he himself was afraid of the humans. So he lowered his tail and his head, and he looked up at the people with his eyes wide to show he was afraid of them and lay down. The dog was lucky because the man who lived in the wigwam had often dreamed of wolves and had in fact dreamed that he would receive a gift from the wolves. In his hunting, he had also appealed to the wolf spirit and had been assisted by it to feed his family. When he returned to the wigwam and saw the harmless wolf dog lying there by the fire, well, he decided to make friends with him. Remembering his dreams, the Indian man told the dog that they would be brothers forever. And to prove this, he would take the dog as his companion when he went hunting for his family and share the meat that they got together. Isn't that something? Well, I've got another little short tale, and this one is about a fox and a wolf. One fox and a wolf were traveling in the winter. The only food that they had with them was a birch bark basket full of maple sugar. Well, they came to a frozen lake, and the fox suggested that some fish would go very well with the sugar they had. So they cut a hole in the ice, and the fox suggested that the wolf use his tail for bait and stick it down through the hole in the ice. The fish would bite his tail, and then he could just simply toss them up on the ice by flicking his tail. Well, the old wolf put his tail down in the water and waited for the fish to nibble at it. But it was so cold that the ice froze around his tail, and he could not pull it out. While Wolf was trying to get his tail free, the fox ate up all the maple sugar and ran away. Yes, there are tales from all over the world about wolves. Wolves have held a unique fascination for mankind from the first time a human ever laid eyes on them, and I'm sure that this will go forth and stay the same as long as there are wolves in the world. Well, thank you for listening. This has been the Wolf Tejas Den.
No going back now.
Now, Cat Wolf Dancer joins us with Ask Cat.
Wolf Dog Radio is proud to present an interactive portion where you can send your questions and have them personally answered by Cat Wolf Dancer. Just send your questions to AskCat at wolfdogradio.com.
Well, everybody, the
clock on my iPhone tells me we've reached that point in the show when it's time for us to Ask Cat.
Greetings and salutations, fellow travelers. This is Ask Cat, and welcome to the wide, wide world of wacky wolf dogdom. Our first question is from Cynthia Rishaw. What are some of the common misconceptions regarding phenotyping mid to low-content wolf dogs? And to take it a step further and apply that to rescues and pounds phenotyping wolf dogs. These are great questions, Cynthia, and I've been fascinated by the art of phenotyping for a few decades now. Gosh, that makes me sound so old. So this question is really interesting to me. Phenotyping is more of an educated art than it is a science. And like most biological sciences, it's more fluid and adaptable, like evolution, than it is strictly inflexible, like math. Also, phenotyping is an amassed collection of observable traits. That includes conformation, that's the physical structure, and behavior. However, behavior is even more fluid, and one must remember when phenotyping any animal that any and all behavior exhibited by wolves is also exhibited in one degree or another in dogs, and vice versa. It's a sliding scale of intensity. Wolves bark. They don't bark like dogs. Dogs stalk. They don't stalk like wolves. In my experience, some of the more common misconceptions are that mid-contents and low-contents have to look just like a wolf, and any obvious dog-like quality means that it can't be a wolf dog. Traits like blue eyes or curled tails or off-standard coats really seem to throw people off, especially in the lower mids, when in actuality, either of these traits can be borne by a mid-content. If you break it down to this, that if a mid-content has approximately equal parts wolf and dog, and that every single attribute is individually inherited, some linked with others, but some completely on their own, and that the combination and recombination of the alleles are both random and nearly infinite, then it's logical to assume that any particular trait found in a dog can also be found in a mid-content, as long as the parents or the grandparents exhibited or carried that trait, right? Well, some traits require both parents to exhibit or carry, like blue eyes. There is some conflicting research on this, but I believe that the conflict lies in a misunderstanding of what is genetically carried by certain breeds of dogs and not by wolves. However, if that element is present, then it's completely logic that puppies would exhibit and carry the trait. In the case of blue eyes, frankly, it takes careful breeding, so you don't see it often because, again, frankly, there are just not too many wolf dog breeders out there who are actually have a breeding program and don't just breed the animals they happen to have on hand. And this trait requires careful planning and pedigree knowledge. In low contents, phenotyping gets a bit trickier. You really have to know your dog breeds and their standards as well as what mixes of the usual suspect breeds look like in combination, and then contrast and compare them with basic wolf anatomy. In order to effectively phenotype, you have to be able to recognize that a German Shepherd Collie mix is not going to look at all like a Malamute Shepherd mix, and neither of those looks at all like a Husky Shepherd mix. Generally speaking, phenotyping is more effective when you study and recognize the obvious dog traits, and then whatever is left over is compared to wolf conformation. A friend of mine, Richard Vickers, has always said, don't try to find the wolf in the wolf dog, try to find the dog instead. It's much easier. One trait will likely lead to two, three, four, or more. What's left will likely be the wolf. The study of phenotyping will make one understand dogs better as well as understand wolves better. As for rescued pound critters, you take all that and then you add the element of fear and lousy photography and people who jump to conclusions, and you've got big trouble. It's very difficult to get good shots in a tiny kennel with lousy angles. Often the animals jump up on the fencing because they want out, or they huddle in the back because they're terrified. How does a person get a good feel for what a canine has inherited, especially lows and mids, from a photo where the animal is pressing himself or herself against the fencing on his or her hind legs? Or even if you're there in person, it's very difficult. Or how about if a photo was taken from a sharply downward angle? Also, there's this fact that a photograph is one frame within several tens of frames worth of movement. An example is a tail movement. If you take a picture of an animal waving their tail, you may very well capture a movement which would lead one to believe that the tail is curled, when in fact the tail is straight but moving through a sweep, which one frame has captured. Tails are very flexible and communicative. So in particular with rescued animals, we've got to make positive sure that the people who are offering the assessment actually have the experience and the reputation to offer that evaluation to the shelter, because shelters can be our biggest advocates, and they can wind up being one of our biggest adversaries. One bad move on behalf of an evaluator can mean death to an animal. Now, I know that there's a contingent within the wolf dog community which resists the fact that misrepresentation kills. However, an inaccurate phenotype of a lupine-looking canine has been and will continue to be deadly in an animal which winds up in rescue. The case of Karma from California is an excellent example. Phenotyping stated the animal was a dog, mislabeled as a wolf dog, and when that canine caused problems by escaping and was genotyped by U.S. Davis as something like 8% wolf, was deemed by an undereducated authority figure as an illegal, dangerous wild animal and slated for euthanasia. It was only by the efforts of an amazing collective of animal advocates and a legislator, that's really important to note, that Karma was not that Karma was able to be placed in a rescue rather than destroyed. We will probably never be able to control what silly fantasies some humans insist on in order to make themselves feel special. But what we can do is educate ourselves, educate our local animal control, our legislators, and continue to advocate for responsible animal ownership. Thank you for the question, Cynthia. I hope I helped explain it a little. Our second question is from Miriam. Question for the Wolf Dog Radio. It seems to be that owning or breeding a high-content wolf dog is like having the Holy Grail. Why are people more interested in owning or breeding high contents? Well, Miriam, that's the $50 question, isn't it? I've got to answer you subjectively, Afir. I am just not going to be able to be very objective. I don't think that there is a definitive answer. I call this the Disney syndrome. When a breed of animal becomes popular, many people just don't take the time to get the specific education required for good animal husbandry as a companion, but instead they get the newest fad, possibly as bragging rights, or as an impromptu, ego-driven decision without the foreknowledge that this is a 15-plus-year commitment and that these critters need above and beyond containment and experience. If people actually spent a little time with rescues and sanctuaries who housed high contents, if people actually spent some time with high-content animals, maybe particularly during the winter months, I think many people would change their minds about just how well a high content can fit into a lifestyle. We are the ones that need to change our whole lives once you get a high content. They're not the ones who need to adjust. We have to. It might also have to do with the unfortunate human penchant to objectify animals as stock. High contents are perceived as worth more. When you have breeders getting $5,000 for a puppy, that is a mighty powerful incentive. For myself, I think wolf dog breeding as a business proposition as opposed to a fancy or a hobby breeder is one of the worst things that's happened to wolf dogs. It's made them commodities as opposed to companions, ego objects as opposed to pets. High-content wolf dogs are fascinating, intelligent companions, and I would never, ever suggest that no one should own them. But they're just not the kind of companions that deal well with undereducated or underprepared owners. Unfortunately, some people recognize that there is profit to be made, and some people value profit above all and do not recognize the value of the being that they own or sell as anything other than monetary. This is true for all animal ownership, not just wolf dogs. Else there would never have been a human slave trade or puppy mills or strip mining or anything like that. All we can really do is combat this, is to shun breeders who commodify their animals and educate ourselves. Suffice it to say that some people feel that owning an animal which not all people can handle gives them a sense of being special. It's just not a particularly positive human trait, but there it is. Like I said, I fear I'm just not very objective in the answering of this question. These are just my personal observations of animal husbandry over a 55-year span. I'm far too emotionally involved to be objective. Well, that's all for now. Thanks so much for listening. And as for these questions, keep them on coming. Good night and be blessed.
Hi, I'd like to introduce myself. My name is Deb. Through my connection with the Wolf Dog community, I was steered in the direction of a local organization that works with wolves and wolf dogs. Little did I know that at the time that I would be so amazed by the work and the effort put forth from In Harmony with Nature Animal Haven in Orlando, Florida, run by the director and author Kim Kitty. I found a sanctuary that is nestled among wonderful oak trees that provides a habitat that exudes peace and calmness for the animals to thrive. A small organization with a huge heart for helping and going above and beyond the call of duty in our community. Check them out at ihwn.org. Give a little, give a lot, spend your time there, and help them make a difference. Thank you.
This is Linda Michaels. And you are listening to Wolf Dog Radio.
Jerry Poles and Julie Myacks Bradshaw for allowing us into their home to discuss and learn the fascinating history of the Sarlos Wolf Dog. If you have specific questions for or about tonight's topic, we invite you to contact them both on Facebook with your questions. These are the insightful types of interviews we love to bring forth as well. We are all learning every day. Please join us on January 23rd as we discuss reproductive issues canines may face, such as pyometra. Studies about this topic, as well as cancers related to reproductive issues, will also be on the agenda. The world we live in twirls and whirls around us so quickly sometimes that we can lose focus of what is going on outside of the invisible binders that we place on ourselves. Accomplishing our personal goals of becoming the person we want to become and not the person our surroundings may be pushing us to become as we stumble through life can be a daunting task. Remember what is important to you and what your goals are. We can only change ourselves. Thank you for listening tonight. I'm Krista Ward. Good night and be blessed. If you have any questions about the show, please email us at questions@wolfdogradio.com and come check out our website at www.wolfdogradio.com for more information.
You are listening to Wolf Dog Radio.